All right, welcome everyone to the first Saturday afternoon session. I'm Hank Dittmar. I'm the chief executive of the Prince's Foundation, and I'm happy to be here with colleagues Marianne Cusato and Dan Tresh from Hardy Products to take on the question of why do our buildings look like crap, and what can we do about it? Last year, we just asked the question, why do our buildings look like crap, and we didn't actually try to answer it. So the innovation this year is to actually try to answer that question. And I, you know, am unable to actually do more than pose the critique, so I've asked two friends to try and help us with that. It's been, I think, a prevailing criticism of the new urbanism that actually, become great at focusing on forming spaces and integrating neighborhoods into the regional framework and other things, that that perhaps the architecture has suffered. And in fact, oft times the architecture is not even controlled by the master plan or the new urbanist who takes it forward. But last year we posed the question that in fact it wasn't necessarily the architecture, it was actually the process and the culture of building that existed in this country alongside the architecture that were to blame, and that you really couldn't tackle the question of beauty in building without talking both about architecture and how we build and what we build from. And so this year we're going to, I think, dig into that a little bit more. And I'm going to make a few remarks and share some of the experiences we've been having the Prince's Foundation, and Marianne will fill in from this side of the pond. The Prince's Foundation is an educational charity, and our model is what we call practice-based learning. It's the idea of what we would say learning, practicing, and teaching. So our model of actually working through a problem is to essentially formulate something that we want to test, an idea that we want to test. And it might be an urban idea, it might be an architectural idea, it might be a research question. And then try that at a small scale, and then begin, and then learn from that, and then roll it out in practice, and then evolve a set of lessons and tools and teach from it. And so we're a practical organization. We get involved in live projects because we believe that you can't actually demonstrate something unless you've done it. It's rather the opposite of the old saw that those who can do and those who can't teach. We think that those who can have an obligation to both do and teach. And we're a part of an organization called the Good Homes Alliance, which is a group of housing developers and suppliers and not-for-profits and universities who are trying to work together to build and promote sustainable homes. Sustainable in not just an energy conservation sense, but in terms of clean air and indoor air quality and beauty and being cared for. And also fitting in an urban realm. And all the developers have agreed to be involved in it. They've agreed to post-occupancy testing to make sure that we meet that they meet the standards in terms of energy, in terms of neighborhood fit and everything else. And so it's a vehicle for taking some of these ideas that we try at the small scale and working them up with a group of aspirational developers who are really trying, I think, to make a difference across all the levels in terms of sustainability. And we've begun to think about a series of questions that challenge traditional building in the UK, and also challenge the emergent model about green building in the UK. That's a little project we did called Lincoln Cathedral. Ben did that one weekend, right, Ben? That's an image from our summer school at Lincoln Cathedral. But most construction of, and I'll focus on residential construction in this presentation. Most construction in the UK is done with brick and block, cavity wall, brick and block, whereas here it's mostly frame. But what we have been looking at is that actually is not a very efficient, energy efficient or green way to build with brick and block. And so we're beginning to think about, are there some different approaches to it? Just an advertisement for our friend Ben Pentreath here, who designed, who was the coordinating architect on this scheme, which won the EcoHome Award of the Year last year. The picture on the left of the Gale and Snowden timber-clad house with the solar panels on it is the one that's featured in all of the presentations about the EcoHome Award. But actually, it was built to the exact same standard as all of those houses on the right, and they all perform at the same level. And so one of the other things we're trying to think about is, and the only difference, according to the developer, is that the one on the left took a lot longer to sell than the ones on the right. And they did find someone who was interested in living in it. But if we want to evolve toward a green building, it probably merits us to think about doing it in all of the approaches that will appeal to the market. And by and large, at least in the UK, most home buyers prefer a traditional house. We visited some of the people who live in these houses, and I remember one couple and sitting down and having a cup of tea with them, and the husband said, "Yeah, I really wanted the greenhouse." And the wife said, "I wanted the traditional house." And then she said, "I won." And he said, "I won." So I think their battle still goes on. So in thinking about this question of how do we begin to build beautifully and build well and build simply so that quality can be built in a way that can be handled by the ordinary person on the construction site, we've begun thinking about, we've begun looking at a variety of bits of research. And this is a study that was done for British Gas and the Prince's Foundation in 2006, and they measured leakage of heat from a bunch of different building types. And they found that the most efficient building types in terms of heat leakage were Tudor and Victorian solid-walled masonry buildings. And that 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s buildings, although there was variation in the 80s and 90s buildings, performed had a lot more leakage than did the Tudor and Victorian houses, and the researchers attributed that to the fact that while the building codes for the most part were much more stringent obviously than in the 80s than they were in Tudor times when they didn't have building codes, the workmanship was poor and there were lots of gaps in the walls and most often the cavity wall didn't even have that insulation that was specified, and nobody had gone back to check it. So as we begin to think about these things, maybe actually simple high thermal mass buildings are a way to go. And so we've begun to think about how do you do that. And this research was buttressed by some work done by Robert Lowe at University College of London looking at solid wall versus cavity wall buildings, and discovering that solid wall buildings, even though not given a green retrofit, were more efficient than cavity wall buildings, but that after you do all of the things like roof insulation and wall insulation and changing out the boiler, they ended up being more efficient. So never being afraid to buck the tradition of building somewhere, we decided to look at this. And Ben Bulger, who's sitting in the front row here, is our director of design theory, led a summer school at Lincoln Cathedral to look at the question of building beautifully and building green at the same time, but doing so with some new materials that actually might challenge the approach to architecture. And so we did that with a program that we have to try to inculcate a culture of building beautifully with young apprentices. And this is the Prince of Wales Traditional Building Craft Apprentice Program, which is an intensive residential program in traditional building skills. that this year focused on greening traditional buildings. And they come to us for a summer school after they've achieved some basic skills in masonry or carpentry or roofing, and we put them through a program to become master craftsmen, involving a summer school, a series of master classes, and then placements on both new builds and on heritage buildings like Windsor Castle and Fountains Abbey and other things. In other words, we give a limited set of people the experience of a lifetime and use the media to promote the idea that actually building well is something that people should aspire to as a career. As a part of trying to contribute something to the rebuilding of New Orleans, we, with the support of a donor, Joe Cannizzaro, in New Orleans, we brought four New Orleans craft workers, two teachers from a trade school, two carpenters from a union, to the program, and they participated. And that, I think, we're going to try to take forward with an expansion this year and hopefully a summer school in traditional building in with both architects and craftspeople in New Orleans and the Mississippi Gulf Coast in the future. So the students worked with Ben and some other architects over a two-week period to build two wall sections with different green materials. The first is aerated clay block, which is a German product, which is uses about 30% less carbon to make than brick. And it's a large block that has holes in it. It's also grooved so they fit together very closely with mastic rather than mortar, and so it goes up very quickly and creates a very good seal. It's classified as a modern building material because it is engineered, these are two wall sections that were. This is one wall section that was created in a one-week period by Ben and his team, using triple glazed windows, a stone plinth, and these blocks. And I think Ben had also had a fresco behind it. Is it this one? Yeah. So the idea was to build something which we could test, discover whether it could be built easily on site, and also see if we could make something that actually was beautiful. And this is a more classical, wall section. The second project was one using hempcrete. This, I think, is illegal in the United States because it's made of hemp, which is derived from the plant Cannabis sativa. But it's a mixture of lime and hemp. Which is the material that's been used for making rope. I think you could use a variety of reedy plant materials, and it's poured and built very quickly on site. It's a wet material, and this is a vernacular wall section that was built during that one week period as well. It also has high thermal mass. It has the benefit of actually fixing carbon because you're using living plant material in the wall, made another beautiful kind of wall. This is the alternative that's being promoted for zero carbon housing in the UK, and we have a rule that we will create zero carbon houses by 2016. And it's got nine layers in it, including a sort of vapor lock material just inside the wall. It's highly engineered, built in a factory. And brought to site and assembled on site by people who are not highly engineered. And in most of the instances where it's being built, they're having real trouble actually dealing with thermal bridging that happens because it's not assembled to the very precise specifications. It also, with nine layers, is absolutely airtight and watertight. But if you break any bit of the water seal and you get water inside, then the inorganic artificial materials in the wall start to do funny things. And I was sort of troubled by this when I went into one of the buildings and got a headache immediately. It also, because it's airtight, it depends on a mechanical system for changing the air a number of times a day, and then it strips the heat from the air and then puts the air back out. So we thought this would be kind of hard to roll out in every one of the 280,000 houses being built in the southeast of England. And we thought, well, maybe this system that we're doing could be simpler, easier, and achieve similar results. And so we challenged our friends at the Building Research Establishment to work with us in assembling one of these houses from the aerated clay block on this site, which is their innovation park. And these are all green houses that have been built by various manufacturers there for the purpose of testing zero-carbon houses. And you'll note the elegant urban assemblage on the site. But they're all testing different materials, and some are testing multiple systems within the building. And so we're going to try to put a building at the end of that site that, with a general spec, that materials would come from the ground or be grown, and try to achieve very similar energy conservation standards as the other as these greenhouses. These are some initial drawings that we're still working through. We've done a site visit to the area around the BRE Park, which is in North London. So we went to look at sort of the between the wars North London architecture, North suburban London architecture, and it will grow from that. Ben can answer when we get to the questions, some questions about how that building will be working. And we're beginning to then think about taking some of these ideas, the lime hemp and the aerated clay block projects, forward with house builders. And we've been master planning the reclamation of this 1,000-acre refinery in South Wales, and a developer has just come on, and we have been asked by British Petroleum, who owns the site, to do the first 50 houses as a standard of quality and a standard of ecological excellence. So we'll be deploying one of these house types there in the next few months. With a house builder with whom we work named Paul Newman Homes, the same effort going forward, and this one is with the lime hemp material on a site outside Stamford, where we will do these three houses as a test with the house builder of taking this notion to the field and seeing how the builder's team can actually work with the new material and work to detail it on site. One further is Ellen, where we're working with with Urban Design Associates to produce a pattern book for the Highlands of Scotland. This is one page from the pattern book, and working on both the urban extension and the revitalization of the city center of Ellen, which is a town in Aberdeenshire that sort of got enveloped by suburbs in the last 20 years. And we're looking at this house builder, who's a volume house builder, at rolling out the aerated clay block with the pattern book as a method of transforming their entire approach to building. We think the benefits of this kind of approach, simple, solid-walled masonry buildings, if we can get them right, is that you can achieve high levels of energy efficiency and indoor comfort. You can create a material that is relatively easy to build on site and goes up quickly and allows more time for getting the details right, at which point we will call Marianne and Ben to help us get the details right. I just conclude by saying that with this image of Poundbury from the Iron Age hill fort at Maiden Castle, and just say that Poundbury looks like it has always been there, and I think that is one of the things that, as we move toward dealing with sustainability and environmental efficiency, that's one of the things we ought to do. Another is to emulate buildings like this, which is the Guildhall at Totnes, built on the foundations of a priory in 1048. It's been the magistrate's court. It was been the jail. It's been the town hall, and now it's the town museum. The stone came from 30 miles away, the slate from under 50 miles away. I took some environmental builders to this site, and they couldn't understand why I was showing it to them and talking to them about sustainability. But it has been there for 1,000 years, and it's been adapted and reused for 1,000 years. And so the embodied energy of that stone has been well and truly depreciated over time. And thinking about building well and building beautifully, we also need to build adaptably, and we need to build places that can change and be loved enough to be kept over time. And they needn't be high art. This is not a high art building, but they need to be of a place. And in some ways, I think the radical notion of beginning to build solid-walled buildings again has something to do with that sense of permanence, that sense of adaptability and being loved. Thank you, and I will ask Marianne to come up, and I'll let you handle your computer. Thanks.
When I first started on this topic, I've been working on it for quite a few years now. Why do our buildings look the way they do? I was convinced that the real reason was literacy, that if we could control what went on the paper and we could control how it was interpreted in the field, it would all be okay. And I've sadly every time I keep getting into it, I realize that the issue is deeper. Once I realized that, you know, there are those two sides of it, then there's actually the issue of if the guy in the field can't get the bits and pieces to do what's on the drawing, there's nothing he can do to make it look right. So there's another layer of it. But it actually goes deeper than that into the mentality of what it is that we're building and who's building it and who they're building it for. So my talk today is looking at that, looking at both the literacy side in terms of what goes on the drawing, what goes into the bits and pieces that make it up, and the builder putting it together. So there's that side of it. But there's also the default setting that we're engaging in a much larger building industry, which is not doing what we're talking about at this Congress. Most of the building industry is out there building the regular, you know, garage front snout houses, the McMansions. And the issue is we're engaging in such a small piece, so we're pulling in from everywhere. We're getting the developers, the builders, the real estate agents, where everybody else is coming with this default setting. And that's, I think, really at the heart of the default setting of what we think about when we approach building. So we'll also start with a disclaimer that my avoid images are hopefully offending nobody in this room. If they are, my deepest apologies, but there is a lesson to be learned. It really starts with where we think. Most of us, if we're doing buildings, think about the building. And that's where we start, and that's where we stop. In a lot of cases for our developments, this happens at eighth-inch scale or quarter-inch scale. But this is actually the first issue, is that we're not thinking about the global implications. We're not thinking about the town. We're not thinking about the streetscape or the materials. Now, I say we when I'm talking specifically about the building design. And this is an important point, because the streetscape, as we all know, and this is why we're here, is much more than the individual buildings together. And this is something, I do a lot of consulting work with builders and architects and developers, and I used to actually exclusively work within traditional communities. But what I've found quite recently is that I'm getting a lot of calls from conventional guys that are doing the garage front house on the cul-de-sac. And it's a fascinating, sort of interesting sort of dynamic between the two. Because I'm going out and engaging with these guys and actually ending up having the exact same conversation with them that I'm having with people in the traditional communities. It ends up being the same thing. And I'm shocked at how many times I have to say, you're not the only building on the street. And what shocks me is that I'm actually saying that more to the guys in the traditional communities. Because I'm actually thinking that that's the conversation I'm having with the guys that are doing the every element on the house. But what's really happening is that we're trying to put every element into every building. And it's really only after we think about everything that we can go back to thinking about that individual house. So before we delve too much into the buildings, let's take a second and talk about what makes a great design. For me, it took going to the architects in the room will know, Vitruvius, and the whole idea of firmness, commodity, and delight. And I think there's the message here that sort of was written in 22 AD, which is as applicable today, if not more, than then. And if we think about this in terms of our design, in terms of the function of it, you know, if you have a building that works, it's going to inherently have more value than one that doesn't work. It's at a fundamental level. But we don't design buildings that work. We don't design houses that live the way humans live. It's all designed around, in a lot of cases, the size and square footage of a checklist that we believe that we need. And so the first step is just thinking about it in terms of that. The next is the cost, the efficiency of building it and maintaining it over time, which is crucial in terms of the decisions that we make, and the third being design. Now, it's easy to achieve two of these, but what's actually really difficult is to achieve all three of them together. And you can have a building that functions and is affordable, but if it looks horrible, it's just barracks. You can have any two of these, but it's getting the third in place that's really the crucial key. And, you know, there are a lot of sort of failures in our industry that we're constantly going up against. So what I find quite interesting is actually to look at other industries and look at the success stories of other industries. And this is the company Method. You may have seen them in Target. They're the seventh fastest growing privately owned company in the U.S., which is, you know, pretty amazing stat. And they're successful because they work on all of these levels. They function well. The premise of the company was to come up with a green cleaning product that people weren't allergic to. And, you know, a lot of people have done that. But they did it in a way that they said, well, it's not enough to have something that people aren't allergic to. It has to be something that actually performs as well as the regular Windex and everything else, because we can't trade down to be green. And so often that's the choice, either, you know, sacrifice or be or just, you know, have performance. They went further than that, though, and they made sure it was affordable. It's something that you can get at Target. And then they went a third step, and they made sure that the bottles and the packaging looked great. And they did this in a way that you want to have a very utilitarian product sitting out. And the fascinating thing that I find now is if you start looking at some of these other, like Windex bottles have gotten a little nicer, and they're influencing the rest of their industry. I think we can take a lot of lessons from this, a lot of lessons from products like the iPod, which is very efficient, it's easy to maintain, it works well, yet it looks great. And that look, that piece of it is absolutely crucial. So back to the building. We'll start with Mr. Potato Head. I think he is the absolute best model for how to build and how to think about a building. You've got the mapping of it, the piece, and then everything else that goes into it. I mean, the first piece, this is something that's absolutely crucial. You know, buildings actually are quite anthropomorphic. Everything we do as humans, everything we touch, actually becomes really centered around the human figure. And the elements that we put into it are also based around that. And when we think about that in relation to building, then we actually get a little further away, or further towards, building great buildings. We all know this. This is the enemy, the sort of the evil empire of the default setting of the building industry. The snout houses, some of them have a big snout, some have a little snout, and the McMansions. The McMansion is really a reaction to the snout house. It evolved because, you know, if you look at that, the image, the little beige house there, the only people that live in that house are people that can't afford to live in any other house. And they'll actually even admit that. It's what they can get in. And that mentality of building creates massive issues. But it also is coming to an end with too many houses on the market. So it's a quite good time to be doing the type of work that we're doing, because it's really proving that design matters and that no longer can we do that default setting. But the problem is this default setting is so ingrained in what we do, even when we code it out, we can't get rid of it. So as planners, you know, we can say, you can't have the garage in front. You can code against this. You can fix the garage in front. You can force it behind the house. You can force it in back. And you can give the streetscape back to the person. You can code against this. This is another problem, the McMansion. The roofscape that never ends. You know, one thing, you can sort of try and convince the builder that he's wasting money every time he puts up a gable. But you can also code against it. You can stop it from happening. The third sort of massive issue of the McMansion is the materials that are sort of applied like a patchwork quilt. And the elements that sort of look like they can take off. My sort of general rule is, if it looks like it will launch, it's a bad thing. But the issue of it is you can get rid of all of these things. You can get rid of it on paper, but you can't get rid of it in how people think. And that's what I'm really running into, is that people are going, the builders that I'm working with are attempting to bring this in. I can't sell a house if I don't have a patch of brick. I can't sell a house if this, and this is what they're coming to it, because of the default setting, because the developer is being held hostage by the builder, who says, I have to build this because this is what I need to sell. The builder is being held hostage by the homeowner, who says, well, I need my brick to sort of feel like I'm, you know, this little sort of 100 square foot patch, and then the vinyl sides and no windows, you know, that whole default setting. And they're being held hostage then by the real estate agent, who says, you can't do it if you don't sell it. You know, you can't purchase this because you won't be able to resell it if it doesn't have this checklist. And so what's happening is those people that are doing that default setting are coming into the traditional communities and bringing it with them. And so here I've sort of boiled down six common mistakes that, and of course how to avoid them, of the building industry and how we can approach this, how we can combat this default setting. The first is, this is where most people start when they're designing a house. Start with the floor plan. In the case of the McMansion, of course, it has all of its little bits and pieces coming out of it, and the very last thing anyone does is put a roof on it. And of course, by the time it gets to that point, they're so committed to the plan that you can't put a roof on it. The second thing they do is look at the front elevation. Now, what shocks me when I look at a lot of T&D plans is the number of plans and front elevations that at a glance actually look okay. But then you'll realize that, you know, it's like a narrow plan like this might have, a little short ridge, or, the ridge would be sort of completely independent, actually, of what the elevation does. When you actually look at the elevations, the ridge in some cases has no bearing on how it's actually built. So you might have, it ends up being really steep sides with really low, front and back, and these crazy roof mathings, which could make absolutely no sense because somebody's designing a two-dimensional elevation and they're not thinking about it beyond that. So my recommendation is actually ignore those two things. Maybe create a bubble diagram, but start with the roof plan. Start with the lid that's going on it. And if that works, then move on to the side elevation. Get all of your design energy out at this point. This is where you want to put it. You want windows on the side. Maybe this is where the bay windows go. All the extra elements. And then go back to the front. Because what happens then is you have a house that works on four sides. And then you have a house that works all the way around. And, it's interesting because that's the conversation that I have all the time with guys that are doing McMansions. But I'm shocked at the number of times I have to have it with people that are building simple streetscapes. The second common mistake is using too many elements. It's sort of the McMansion in a box. There's this idea that sort of every element is necessary to sell a house. It's not. And what really comes down to is, if you have a limited budget, every element that you put on the house costs money. And every time you do that, you reduce the specification on the other ones that are going on the house. So if you build a house that has a really nice front door and a nice eave, spend the money then on the windows. Don't keep adding. This is an example of a house, two houses, which at a glance are actually the same house. They're very similar. But one of them has just completely wasted money, and one of them is much more refined and is going to look nice on a streetscape. And this is the type of conversation that it's not about, on one hand, it's about how it feels. Now, on the other hand, is reaching out to builders and being extremely practical about how you present it. And this is my conversation with them. It's like, okay, this is how we fix this house. First, save money on the dormers. Just get rid of them. Not necessary. And every time you put a dormer on a house, in most cases, dormers go on homes not because they're putting light in the attic, but because they're covering up a really ugly roof line that people are trying to protect against. If you've thought of the roof line first, then you don't need the dormers to fix your mistakes. It's about sort of getting the bones of the building right, getting that sort of the base, the potato, before you have to put on all the other stuff to fix it. And in so many cases, like a lot of people call me up and say, can you come, can you help re-elevate this building to fix it? And, the response is, unfortunately, there's no amount of details I can put into a building to fix a building that has a crazy roof plan. There's nothing that I can do to fix the map. You know, no sort of beautifully elegant door surround is going to fix a building that has horrible massing. There's nothing you can do that. So pull the details off. Don't waste your time with them. Just have a simple form. The next thing is to, you know, we don't need all the steps. It's more affordable to put windows in that are coherent than to continue to change everything. So far, the changes I've made have saved the builder or the developer money. This is the first one that I would recommend doing that would add money, and that is to put shutters on that work. Just don't waste your time with it. If it doesn't work, don't use it, or at least look like it could work. It's a matter of choosing where the money goes. Building is going to cost money, and it's choices. You know, we don't have an endless budget. So this is, I think, in the end, the discussion that will make architecture better and make the buildings look better is when we have the money conversation with them. They say, we're saving you money here, we're saving you money here. You have to reallocate a little of it here, and then overall, you'll be able to sell the house for more. The next thing is to just continue on putting deeper shadows in, making it be something that actually works. Having a porch that's usable. And these two houses together, one of them is more simple and feels nice on the streetscape, and one of them just continues to add to the chaos. If my graphic skills were better, I would have carried on and taken the keystones out from over the windows, which is a huge pet peeve of mine, because it's like, you know, what is the keystone doing there other than wasting money and being a distraction because it's never detailed right? You know, so it comes down to, you know, choosing what you do and doing it well, and don't feel like you have to do everything, because it's absolutely not necessary when you think of buildings together on a street. And it seems like such a basic thing to say, but it's extraordinary the number of times that it's necessary to say it. So at the other end of the spectrum is the house that has too few elements. It's like, and very, very minor modifications could fix this, but it goes back to buildings being anthropomorphic. I mean, the windows or the eyes, you know, we're sort of cutting them out. And these buildings are basically the same building. It's almost identical. But with very, very minor modifications, it can be fixed. You know, this one is a matter of just adding two windows and two posts. And the building is transformed from one that looks like it's sort of missing its pieces to one that will feel nice in the landscape. You know, the image is a very sort of young image of this development, but imagine it once there's grass, trees, and everything else growing up, that it would feel really nice. And it's just a matter of where we put our budget. And in that case, you know, adding the two windows, absolutely, my solution is a little more expensive. But in the end, it's absolutely also worth it. So common mistake number four is forgetting common sense. And, you know, if we just go back to really what a building is, it's at its very core level, the purpose of a building is to stand up and keep water out. That's it. You know, we think of it as more than that. It needs to be more than that. But it also, at its very basic level, is that. And the problem is that right now, if you think it up, you can build it. You can build absolutely anything that you can think of, because structural engineering will get you off the hook for a span that doesn't work. And mechanical systems get you off the hook for windows that are inoperable. And, you know, all of these things, flashing fixes moldings that allow water to drip down the face of a building. So all of these things that we used to have to protect against with the designs and the details, now no longer, that is released. And so it's part of the reason why the building elements have become so chaotic. The best rule of thumb I can say is it doesn't necessarily have to work, but it needs to look like it could work. And if it doesn't, don't put it on. You know, the shutters that could never, ever close. But, you know, it's just like, these are the things that when you walk down a street, you know, you don't have to have a degree in architecture to know it feels wrong. You don't know what's wrong, but it feels wrong. And as I equate it to listening to music, you know, I can't sing anything in tune, but I can tell you if someone else isn't. And it's that inherent quality of understanding architecture, art, beauty, and design of all sorts that we understand when something's not quite right. And this is, you know, so many of the new urbanism developments are sort of saying, well, it doesn't feel right, it looks like a cartoon, it looks like Disney. You know, we've heard it a million times. And it's because we've lost the common sense approach to building. And this is an issue of literacy. This has nothing to do with the default setting of what we're bringing to it. This is just pure and simple literacy of understanding the elements of architecture and thinking about them, and it's a really easy test. Could it work? Just ask yourself that. Style is always an issue at the CNU. No one ever wants to talk about it, but I'm going to talk about it. I personally sort of come to the architecture from a traditional approach, but it really drives me crazy, and I do think that Andreas has said it a million times, that the enemy of traditional architecture is not modern, but it's just really bad traditional. And the style is a huge question. I would like to point out that a colonial revival building built in the year 2008 is not a colonial revival, it's a colonial revival revival. You know, we're not fooling anyone. And so the sort of one thing about a lot of our projects is that we very much sort of go back to this approach of trying very hard and very self-consciously to recreate things which we can't quite recreate. And this sort of very self-conscious sort of attempting to create pattern books of things, which on one hand are extremely valuable and extremely useful, but on the other hand actually create more problems for us than we really than we fix. And it's because of the approach that comes with it, not because of the action itself, but because we're trying very hard to recreate things. The fact of the matter is, we're building in the year 2008. We're building now, we're not building historically. So what we need to do is look at the best of where the style came from and build what's appropriate for today with today's materials. Not saying that necessarily means everything needs to be FIPON, but it means that we need to be realistic to the point of how we use what is available to us so it doesn't become kitsch. You know, I'm sort of handed drawings all the time that'll look like every other house, but it'll have three brackets on it, and someone tells me that it's an arts and crafts house. Well, it's not, and it's not, if we're really going to build styles, we need to build styles. But what some of the best traditional communities, I think the most successful ones, are the ones that are just building houses and not necessarily tied to pretending to be a style, and that it's an important distinction to make. My final point, the common mistake number six, is not worshiping false idols. I love Martha Stewart, absolutely love her. I used to get the magazine, I stopped. I sometimes secretly do watch the show. But I think she's an excellent example of sort of how the industry, and this goes back to the perception issue. We can fix literacy with understanding and documents and with just practice. We can fix that. But the mindset that comes with the building industry right now is really a problem. And it's creating these, these really are McMansions in a box. They're pretending to be styles. And this is really at the heart of a lot of what we're facing today. And it's going to lead to what Dan's presenting. Because one of the massive issues is people fear, is a real fear-based just sort of limiting of what we build. I mean, we run into it all the time with the fear of density, with the fear of all of these things that we talk about with the urbanism. But there's a massive issue with the fear of the architecture, of people coding in things, trying to make design better, or in some cases sort of keep the poor people out by coding the buildings. And this is, we're a nation of followers. I mean, everything, if so-and-so does it, then it'll be okay. If this builder's doing it, and, if this homeowner's purchasing it, and of course we're a nation of followers, because in the end, if you're building something, it's a massive expense, and you want to sell it. If a homeowner is purchasing something, it's a massive investment, and you want it to be worth something. So there's the whole issue of being practical, but there's also the issue of the default setting that we're using to be practical, and the issues that we're sort of raising, some of which are realistic and some of which actually have no bearing on common sense or the reality, and it's blocking building good buildings. It's actually getting in the way, and these issues of people trying to protect us are getting in the way of good design. This leads then to Dan. Dan Tresh is the Director of Government Affairs for James Hardie Building Products. And it's fascinating, the topic that Dan's going to talk about, because we talk a lot in the new urbanism about things that are illegal, the fire truck that is sort of changing the width of the street, and all of the issues that come with that. We know about all of the things that when you design a new town that are illegal, that a lot of times the plan that goes into place is just illegal. And we think about it at the level of the urbanism. But we don't always think about it at the level of buildings, and that's where Dan is going to take over.
Thank you. Just wanted to take a little bit of time here. I just have a few slides here. Just as Marianne said, I have been kind of on this journey for the last 5 years. They hired me to basically address some of the code issues that are going on out there, the ordinances that are in place in several areas of the country, but probably more so in North Texas, up in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, than probably any other area in the country. At least from what I know, I could probably count the number of ordinances on my two hands outside of Dallas. We probably have about 36 cities in the Dallas-Fort Worth area that have some sort of a percentage for a masonry requirement, and that typically means brick, that there's a large percentage of brick. You know, as far as our company is concerned, we don't have an association. The brick industry has an association. The vinyl industry or the vinyl folks have their own association, but we are the largest manufacturer of fiber cement, the Hardy Board, and we felt that it was necessary for us to get out and do what we needed to do to try to educate the market, mainly city officials and staff, on the merits of incorporating siding-type products into the design in their cities. If you look at the history and where this all came from, those of you that have probably owned homes in the past, say, 10, 15, 20 years probably remember a product called Masonite, which is the engineered wood products, the pressed wood products. And there were several manufacturers. Masonite just happened to have the name out there. They were kind of like Kleenex, but there were several manufacturers of those products, and there was a lot of problems with those products. They were not moisture resistant, and there was a lot of class action lawsuits involving those products. And it was very easy for folks like the brick folks. Incidentally, Dallas is the number one brick market in the country, but it was very easy for them to go into a city. And all those the city folks, they're all familiar with the certain communities within their city. And it was easy to basically say, so-and-so community over here, have you seen the siding on those houses? And typically the siding was swelling and coming off that house unless you kept a good coat of paint on it. And it was a very easy sell for them to think that we need to put this masonry ordinance in place. Obviously, they want to protect their citizens. They want to make sure that folks are protected and that the tax base obviously doesn't erode. So they want to make sure that the products on the exterior are good products and that house is going to maintain its value. There's also, as Mary Ann said, there's also an issue, and that's affordability, affordable housing. And unfortunately, some of the builders out there that have built some of the affordable houses are probably their own worst enemy in that a lot of the houses have been very boxy type houses, whether they're brick or whether they're hardy or whether they're vinyl, and a lot of the cities do not want that type of design. So what they've done, and I've heard this comment several times, what they say is that a brick box is better than a siding box or a vinyl box or whatever. So they've gone forward with these ordinances, and it's obviously impacted the cost of those houses. In fact, right now, I don't know anybody that lives around in this area probably familiar with the case, but there's a case going on where the National Association of Home Builders has teamed up with the NAACP in the city of Kyle. The city of Kyle actually put some ordinances in place that and I don't know if I can remember all of them, but some of them, it was more brick on the house. You had to have larger lots. Believe they wanted larger garages. You had to have certain amount of landscaping in it. Basically, long story short, it pumped the price of the house up about $41,000 on average. So they felt that this was something to push out affordable housing. So the case is actually, from what I understand, the case is going to be, there's going to be a decision on the 14th of April. And I believe that that decision is probably good. You're going to probably see if the NAHB and the NAACP wins the case, then I believe you're going to see the NAHB get much more aggressive with some of the cities out there that are putting these types of ordinances in place. This is not a great quality picture here, but this is pretty typical up in North Texas. You see a lot of these types of neighborhoods. This is a city that has about a 90% masonry ordinance in place. They'll use brick. In many cases, the builder will use brick. Between brick and stone, as you all know, probably is a little bit more expensive than brick. They do throw a little bit of stone on the house. But you're talking about just a lot of square footage in a house, a lot of brick, and not a whole lot of thought and detail as far as the house is concerned. So when I look at neighborhoods like this, whether they're this size of a house, the McMansion type house, or you look at affordable housing, the thing that concerns me long term, and I tell city officials this, are you going to see people in the next 20 to 30 years coming back to these houses and wanting to live in these houses and wanting to put $50,000, $100,000 in these houses to get them back to the original way that they were? And that's probably not going to happen. I try to point a lot of times to the downtown areas, the old areas of a lot of cities around the country, and how people always seem to like to go back. They're always pulled back to those old houses and how they like to put money back into those houses. And I make my point, but again, a lot of the builders think that they need brick on the houses, and we keep fighting the city. And the cities, we're getting close with several cities. Fort Worth approved our product as a masonry product. Plano did. We are finally, after about 4 years with the city of Frisco. Anybody from Frisco in here? With the city of Frisco. They have about an 80% masonry ordinance, but we were finally with the city of Frisco helping them. And one of the things that we gave them was Mary Ann's new book that she just came out with. And they're using that as a pattern book to go back in and come up with some patterns, at least some sort of standards to follow if you're going to do a traditional type home. And so I would say that probably by the end of the year, we'll probably be able to build an all-siding house in the city of Frisco without going through some major variance. A little slower. So these aesthetic-oriented ordinances, as we call them, if you look at houses like this, it becomes something kind of like patchwork, as Mary Ann said. You get the snout garages. The whole design piece becomes secondary. When I hear, when I talk to the design community, when I talk to builders, when they say that they have to meet an 80% masonry requirement, then before they even come up with a great design, they have to figure out how to fit 80% brick on that house. And it's very, very frustrating to the architects out there that I talk to. Because they have to use so much brick on the house, they'll do some shortcuts in other areas, and they're even using the pressed wood type product sometimes to save money on some of the trim areas, and they'll run siding all the way down the house. Those are all things to save money. Now in Texas, we're fortunate enough that the labor pool down here is a little bit less costly than some of the unionized labor up north. And a lot of times, if a builder has to put 80% brick on a house, he'll just run the brick all the way top to bottom and make it a 100% brick house, because they're telling me that to bring out a cornice crew to put 20% siding or some other product on there, it just isn't worth it. It costs them more to bring out an additional crew. So, an example of some ordinances are out there in Georgia, in Gwinnett and Douglas County. These are two ordinances that came into play about 2 years ago, and this was a result of some fires that they had in some communities where they had the homes sitting very, very close to one another. The homes did have vinyl on them in both of these counties, and they basically passed these laws. So rather than really look at saying that you need one large percentage of one type of material, they're actually looking more at performance-based issues and going after the non-combustibility piece of this. And then again, as far as looking at performance-based issues, We are now, I should back up just a little bit. Originally, we went in and we started talking about the city's looking at requiring sustainable products rather than requiring one large percentage of one type of material. But the problem with the definition of sustainability is there's just so many people have a different idea of what that is. And the city folks are just begging us to give them some sort of language. Well, what kind of language are you looking at? Do you have an example from another city? So as we get more and more cities to start looking at more, you know, performance-based issues and tying ordinances to performance, then we'll be able to share those things with these cities, and I think you'll start seeing this thing accelerate. I don't know if you're all aware of this. Those of you that probably live in California, you are, but the state of California, the state fire marshal's office, this is the first time that I know that at least the state has required or put in standards based on performance. And everybody knows the fires that they had back in October and January, and several houses burned. This went into effect January 1, and anything in the wildland urban interface areas, which is a huge area that goes from the top to the bottom of California, and it encroaches and comes into some cities, has to have non-combustible material in the eave areas. The eaves have to be closed, and it on the exterior walls, they have to be non-combustible or ignition-resistant material, and the Hardy products, the fiber cement products, do meet that code in the eave areas and on the exterior. In closing, I would just like to say that if any of you have information in maybe some of your communities, that information on your products appreciating better than other neighborhoods or communities around that are probably predominantly brick, or that are moving faster as far as selling faster than other communities around there. We'd love to have that information. It's those types of things that I think it's going to take for us to get these cities to kind of open up and allow the traditional type of design that we're looking for. Thank you.
We've got about 15 minutes for questions. And I would just say, to kick it off, I was struck by Mary Ann's comment that actually the enemy of the new urbanism is not modernism, but bad traditional building. And I certainly think, as I look at the state of house building in the UK, that's true, and I think it's true here. Of course, the enemy in the media is the architectural critic, but in terms of actually on the ground.
The architectural critics, though, and the architectural press are really only appealing to the architects, and that's such a small percentage that the real issue is the builders and the homeowners, you know, and those are the ones that we need to get to and actually communicate with, that you don't have to have every element. I mean, it's amazing, you know, it's just a matter of everybody's trying to serve the next person, and, you know, it's not even about ideology in some cases, it's just about, it literally is fear, I think, is at the heart of why most buildings look so bad.
I think the question about these so-called aesthetic ordinances is an interesting one because, it goes to the fact that if we create sophisticated tools and then there's a trickle-down effect and they get adopted by communities, you end up with blunt instruments that are misapplied.
I find it fascinating just working a little bit and consulting through some of the people that Dan's worked with, that, you know, we all know about the fire trucks and the issues that we fight there, but nobody's really talking about the issues that we're fighting that make the houses that we want to build actually illegal in some places. And, you know, it's extraordinary, the perceptions of just the city officials that say, well, you have to have X, Y, and Z, and they end up coding in the buildings, basically coding in McMansions.
Yeah, that's very good. Yes.
Patrick Pantel from Houston, Texas. It seems like in the last few days there have been plenty of people that are prepared to talk about sustainability. And I heard a presentation this morning talking about green buildings and high performing buildings, which just gets into issues of functionality. Yesterday there was a presentation about affordability. And going back, Marion, to some of your comments, are we going to look for smaller footprints in the sense that, you know, can't give up something, or we want to hit a higher, attain a higher mark in terms of quality. Environmental issues are pushing us towards higher function. What, does affordability fall out of the bed, or are we going to start smaller houses?
Well, I think smaller houses in a lot of cases actually work better within the new urbanism, because if you, you know, it's one, another one of Andreas's points is if you have nothing outside of the house, you require everything inside the house. So in a conventional neighborhood where you arrive in your car and you stay in there until you get in your car and leave, your house has to be huge. You don't need it to be so huge if you're plugged into a place where you can actually engage with the outdoors, or whether you have a porch. You know, a lot of McMansions, actually, one of the massive issues with them is that they have no outdoor living space that's private or usable in any way. They may be sitting on a one-acre lot, but the moment you go outside, you're completely exposed, and so no one does. If everything's required inside the house, the footprint has to be huge. If you can transfer some of those daily uses, or just the connecting to the outdoors, if you can transfer that into usable space, then the footprint can be smaller and it can be more affordable, and it's also a greener way to build. Because, you know, a lot of the presentations I give, I go to, and I'll, you know, I'll be talking to even homeowners and city officials, and I'll say, well, how many of you actually live in the house that you live in? How many of you live in every room? And, you know, most people just immediately admit that they don't. And what I find even more fascinating is when I'm meeting with builders that are building this crap, basically, then, you know, they'll during the meeting, they're very straight, you know, no, we need this, we need that, we need this. And the moment there's a bathroom break, you learn more at a bathroom break than anything else. Because yeah. The moment there's a bathroom break and they relax and they'll lean over to me and say, yeah, I don't really live in my whole house either. Or they'll say, well, I actually live in a smaller house. So the people that are promoting these huge houses don't even believe in it.
I mean, there's also some simple things. If you think about building types, and if you have attached buildings, row houses are a very good way of saving energy, because you're actually sharing walls, and if you can keep from losing the heat up the party wall, you've got a much more efficient building. It doesn't mean that you have to give up on floor space, and you probably are saving money on construction. And the reason we're trying to play with these new materials that are lower carbon is all about going to scale and creating simple buildings that aren't necessarily more expensive to make, that are high performance. So high performance could be about sophisticated, expensive engineered solutions, but it might actually just be about well-designed buildings as well. Yes?
Peter Kasselbeck with New Jersey Future. When you're having conversations with the different developers, are there certain items that they push back on more than on other items, or are there ones that they seem to be?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. The question is, you know, are there issues that people push back on more? And the you know, I think one of them is this perception that they have to have all of these things in it. And this you know, I was, you know, on the phone for an hour yesterday with a developer who came to me and said, you know, I've done everything within my code to fix this house, but it's still really ugly. And the builder, you know, he met the architectural code, and it's very, you know, it's a good project. It's, you know, it's a DPZ project. They've got the perfect code. But they couldn't couldn't code through this default setting that the builder had, that he was desperate to put all of this crap in the building. And it's just like, guys, you'll save money if you don't. But they feel that they have to, because they have to meet this perception of what they think the market wants. When they, you know, they actually could save money by building a house that looked better.
And are you getting asked to look at their builders' house plans and critique their plan books?
To a point, yeah. And that's the the first thing. Some of them are actually quite fine if you just look. And I talked about it. Looked at the front elevation, yeah. And then when you really actually start looking at it, there's no way you can actually build the house without, you know, crazy things that they're doing to make that work. And so it's just like, you know, if you just simplify it, and it's a really hard thing for someone to do, to hold back. It's really hard for architects. It's almost impossible for an architect not to add the things. And because everybody, you know, everything's a piece of art. And it's just, it's changing that mindset that not everything is necessary. And, you know, then putting the money into other areas. So they'll put the cheapest windows they can put on. They'll put, the, you know, all of these horrible things, the grill between the glass, you know, everything that makes the building look really flat and, you know, just miserable. And yet they'll put a million of those things on. And if they just put half of it on, but put in decent windows, it would be substantially nicer. And that's the point that I think is the most difficult to convey.
Any more questions in the back?
Yeah, I was wondering, you were talking about making buildings lovable enough to want to adapt them to your builders, so an example of that. When you talk about the new building products, are those going to be adaptable enough to come back in and put windows in it or tear things out, or is it going to be like a nine, you know, material modern system that is possible?
Well, the both of those solid masonry things are pretty much, you know, you just go after the masonry, particularly lime hemp. I think that's a criteria we want to look at as we look at different systems. And you know, I just that nine layer thing. If you cut through it, if you have to go back and say, well, actually, I think what I want to put an addition through here, you basically have ruined the building. And the integrity of it, you create all these failures. And so, you can't speak for each system, but we chose the hempcrete and the brick as one that makes sense. Now, as we're starting to dig in with the house builder on the brick, we're starting to look at applying it in Scotland. And there are questions with the brick manufacturer, the clay block manufacturer, about the size of their blocks and the sort of pieces that they have for windows, because in Scotland you put stone around the windows, and there are issues that are probably going to have to be dealt with by having them modify their product over time. And then you get into questions about, are you going to make enough houses to make it worth their while to do that? But, you know, that's the stage we're at. And Bill?
It seems to me that you've all danced around the fundamental issue that drives the whole train here without ever touching about it. That's the customer's concept of aesthetics. The relativist intellectuals, having destroyed the aesthetic canon, whether we're talking art or architecture or music or anything else, what we're left with is, for the vast majority of people, beauty is something that demonstrates that you've spent a lot of money. That's true with women, that's true with buildings, that's true with cars, that's true with clothes, that's true through the whole culture. And until you can fix that, and I have no idea how you fix that as we spiral ever downward in cultural decay, I don't see how you can possibly avoid having your houses being these junk wagon collections of all this stuff on it, because that says you spent a lot of money. By definition, is beauty.
But the thing is, showing that you can actually have a higher specification. If you start building with beautiful windows and actually a really nicely detailed porch, that is, and actually you create places, people that go in those places actually see that it's a real place.
I think that's right. I agree to a point, Bill, that in fact it is. You know, people do look at me like I've passed gas when I talk about beauty in certain architectural circles. But I did it in an architecture school a while back, and they said, "Oh, that was really interesting." So it was a great victory.
Wow.
But
you weren't immediately escorted to the door.
No, but the question, but what I think is that actually people know beautiful things when they see them. When we're time and time again, when we work with people in charrettes, and you ask them what's great about their town, they go and they take you to stuff that's well-designed and well-proportioned and well-detailed. But they don't think it's possible for them to procure that. And particularly with the house, they don't think that the kind of things that were available in an old house are necessarily possible to get at this time. And so I think partly it's about teaching people that these kind of things are possible. Yeah?
I'd like to make a comment about a building being viewed from all four sides, because I review large-scale projects, and a lot of times people do only look at that front elevation. Mm. And when I make comments that all four need to be as beautiful
everybody sees it. I mean, it's just like, it's like saying this glass isn't round, you know? And that's the sort of the point, is that you really sort of need, you know, in two dimensions on paper, this would be, you know, straight. But it's, buildings are three-dimensional, and we can't get away from that just because we're looking at them on paper.
Well, I agree with that. So it's education, because the architects are giving us one thing.
Yeah.
So just my last comment, I think the hodgepodge of materials goes to maybe what people perceived as wealth, maybe in the 50s and 60s, because my parents grew up in an era when you could get a brick house rather than a wood house. It connoted that you were wealthier. And then simple design and simple materials were devalued because they were seen as commonplace. So I think it's social and cultural also.
Yeah.
Right, but it also, it sort of denies, sort of, the problem is it's naturally happened that, yes, a brick house that's actually a proper brick house is, you know, does cost more because, and or a stone house. And they used to actually be load-bearing masonry. It's refreshing to see that you guys actually still do it, and we've lost that. So now it literally is this facade of wallpaper. And, you know, that it goes to that sort of common sense of materials. Masonry is a load-bearing material which builds up on itself. It's not a veneer. And it sort of goes back to that sort of, you know, you don't quite know what's wrong, but it's this, it's because we can't put our finger on it, but it's because we're treating materials not like the actual materials. And, you know, when we start building places again that are actually like buildings that are properly built and can show more of these in markets, then we're going to get away from these preconceived notions of what is valuable.
All right. We're at the concluding moment of the program. Thank you all. I wish next time we'll allow more time for the discussion. That was very interesting. Thanks to our panelists.